I first became a member of Prairie Public when we moved back to North Dakota in 2007. We are members of Prairie Public because we love to listen to the diverse programming. We particularly love the Moth Radio Hour, StoryCorps, and just the different diverse perspectives. I have many driveway moments listening to Prairie Public, particularly with the Moth Radio Hour. I just can't seem to tear myself away without hearing how the story ends. And I just love the complete picture that Prairie Public paints for stories that are presented. I love the sustaining membership option of Prairie Public because it allows me to think about one less thing. I know that I'm contributing to Prairie Public every month, and it's not something I have to think about. I love knowing that my family and I are contributing to Prairie Public to help maintain the stories that you hear. I'm Erica Berg from Kindred, North Dakota, and I'm a proud sustaining member of Prairie Public.
Support all the things you love about Prairie Public by making a sustaining membership contribution. It's easy. Just go to prairiepublic.org or call 800-359-4145.
Welcome to this Tuesday, April 1st edition of Main Street, No Foolin', right here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up in the second half of today's show, Dr. Tom Ezern stops by with another of his great plainsfolk essays. We'll have a report from Harvest Public Media about birds who migrate through the Midwest in spring have challenges due to light pollution and window collisions. Plus, we'll have our weekly segment, Our Living Lands. And we begin Main Street today with Christine Miles. She's written the book, What Is It Costing You Not to Listen? The Power of Understanding to Connect, Influence, Solve, and Sell. Christine, welcome to Main Street.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure for us to visit with you, Christine. Your book is titled somewhat provocatively, What Is It Costing You Not to Listen? Explain to me and to our listeners the hidden costs that people kind of overlook when they fail to listen effectively.
Well, I appreciate that you recognize it was provocative. It was a hard decision to title the book that, but you cannot solve a problem you don't know you have. So most of us don't know we have the problem, that it's costing us because we're told to listen, not taught. And 96% of people, according to Harvard Business Review, believe they are good listeners. 96% of people. So we are underestimating and overestimating our listening abilities. So the cost can be somewhat invisible until they're not. I call it death by a thousand cuts. There's lots of wounds, and then we have a divorce, or we lose a business deal, or our employees leave. It's like oxygen, it's everywhere. So if you cut off the supply, the costs are staggering. It's just everywhere in an organization and everywhere in a relationship.
Generally, as we're going through our school, right, we're told how to speak and how to convince.
Yes.
Never did I have a class on the other side of that. Yeah. Why is that?
Well, my theory and my belief is it's really hard, again, to fix a problem you don't know you have. And listening has been complicated to learn. It's a skill, but because we have two ears, we treat listening like walking. You'll just figure it out. If you have healthy legs, you'll learn to walk. If you have ears that work, you'll learn to listen. But listening and hearing are two different things. So since we've never been taught, and it's hard to teach what you haven't been taught yourself, and it's really complicated. So it's a big lift to put this into teachers' hands and expect them to know how to do it. But this is not a modern problem. This is an ancient Roman times problem. Back as early as man has been speaking, we have been touting oratory skills, rhetoric skills, speaking skills. And so we have to, I believe, treat this very differently and change the paradigm. And that's the mission I'm on, is to bring listening education to all ages. So this is a skill that is learned from elementary school through corporate training programs.
I had planned to ask who your market is for this book, but sounds like everyone kind of fits.
Everyone fits. It's interesting because we have a classroom program as well for elementary schools in the fall. It'll be available for high schools. And we had a fifth and sixth grade teacher who we worked with rolled out the program. And the students initially rated themselves to be above average listeners in sixth grade. When they finished the program, their listening skills improved, among other things, but they also said I would rate myself differently because now I know what listening is. I had no idea what it meant before we started.
What's the biggest mistake that I make and that others likely make when they are supposed to be listening?
Well, the brain goes wild, so I just want to say it's nobody's fault because our subconscious brain or our emotional brain, the things we're not aware of, is like a mischievous child, like telling us to do everything but listen. So the common mistakes that are mostly reported are responding. I want to just respond. So I might want to advise or problem solve. I might want to figure out, I might want to rehearse what I'm about to say. Those are things that that people do. They also mind read. They think I'm supposed to know what you're about to say, especially in the relationships they're most familiar with. But curiosity actually goes up or goes down the more we know somebody. So ironically, the most important people in our lives, we tend to be less curious about because we think we already know. We talked earlier about, I live in Philadelphia. I don't go to the Liberty Bell anymore because I've seen the crack. I know the story. So I'm not curious about it. And that's what happens when we're in conversations as well. We think we're just supposed to know what the person's saying and we don't need to hear it.
You talk about unhelpful listening personas. Mm-hmm. Can you share some examples of those personas and how they negatively impact our relationships, our careers, our life?
Well, there's two primary personas in how we listen. And one is what we call the defense attorney. That's the person that's asking very prescriptive questions based on their own conclusions, their own assumptions, the narrative that's happening in their own brain when they're listening. So we tend to shape the story to prove the case that we're trying to prove on the witness stand. So we'll ask very prescriptive and directed questions that really derail the speaker from the real story. And that happens a lot more often than we think, both in business and in personal conversations. We want to fix problems. We want to know the ending to the story. We rush the speaker along. The other one is what we call the curious detective. And that's the person that allows the story to unfold from the speaker. And we do that by not jumping to conclusions and not making those assumptions. We let the speaker bring the story to us, but we need to guide them in a very specific way to get to being that curious detective.
I'm thinking of myself and I see kind of both sides in that, but sometimes in my job, I am thinking when I shouldn't be about the next question instead of listening and helping you guide me there, but it makes me think of it from the speaker's side. Is there anything from the speaker's side that I should be conscious of when I'm speaking that can help people listen better?
Yes. So here's what I'll say about that. So a couple things. Let me step back. One is, as listeners, here's a hint. When you're listening, you're always listening to a story. So if your child comes home from school and you ask them, how was their day? And they say, good. Believe it or not, that's a story. Your job as the listener is to be the guide to get the speaker to tell their story in a way you can more easily understand. There's a process that I've created around that. It's in the book. When we're speaking, alternatively, we are storytellers. The problem is, even though we've had training over centuries how to speak, and we learn and we're wired to listen and learn from stories, we're pretty bad storytellers in general. So we confuse the listener right off the bat. What most people do is start in what I call the middle of the movie. They don't start at the beginning. So we disorient right off the bat. So as the speaker, once you learn the process of gathering or getting a story, you also learn how to be a better storyteller because the map to getting a story and telling a story are exactly the same. The path is the same. So if you are more organized in how you communicate your story, you're going to help people be a better listener to you.
Listening deeply involves hearing not just what is said, but what remains unsaid.
Yeah.
And oftentimes I'm trying to figure that out without, right now you and I see each other as we're talking.
Yeah.
Sometimes I don't get to see the person that I am visiting with. And it's more difficult, I think, to figure that out. Give us some advice on becoming more attuned to these subtle signals of what's not being said, maybe, but should be said.
Yeah. Well, so I love that you know that you should be attuning to that because so much of what we communicate isn't in our verbal sense. And most people think of good listening as I'm going to make eye contact with you. That's different than what we call listening with your eyes. And that can be on a phone call. That doesn't have to be face-to-face like you and I are, even though it's virtual. It can mean that I'm listening for the emotions. I'm listening for the pauses. I'm listening for the tone of your voice. We can listen with our eyes in a lot of ways that help us understand what's not being said. There's ways to predict what people do. When you know what you're looking for, remember I remember the dentist's office, the highlights. You'd look for the bear and the tiger. And if you don't see the key, you don't know what you're looking for, right? So that makes it a lot harder to find all the animals in the kingdom or the forest. So we need to have the key. And believe it or not, like when we listen, there's certain things that we can predict that are going to happen from the speaker. Once you know them, you have the key to the highlights, you know what you're looking for, it becomes a lot easier. But the first step is to realize it's not about eye contact. It's about listening in a way that you're using your eyes and your ears in a different attunement. I'll give you one really good way that people can learn to attune. Here's a practice way to do it. So how many times in a day do we say to somebody, how are you doing? How's your day going? And the answer is usually, hey, good, right? And most people aren't saying, hey, no, today really sucked. I'm having a tough day. We don't tend to go there initially. But how people say good really makes a difference. So yeah, it's pretty good. Isn't most of us run past that and just say, oh, he or she said good. It's how they say good and what you do after they say that changes the game. I've been on Zoom calls with people I've never met and they give me one of those, oh yeah, it's been pretty good. I said, well, that doesn't sound great. Tell me more. And before you know it, I'm in a completely different conversation because I attuned to that very obvious nonverbal kind of hesitation and went a little deeper. And then people open up in a whole different way.
We're enjoying our conversation with Christine Miles. Her book is What Is It Costing You Not to Listen? The Power of Understanding to Connect, Influence, Solve, and Sell. The book argues persuasively that poor listening has real measurable costs from lost business opportunities and workplace inefficiencies to strained personal relationships. And Christine offers a roadmap to reclaim those losses through intentional listening practices. Christine, your personal history includes being shaped profoundly by listening due to your mother's struggles with mental health, and you write about that. How did this early life experience guide you and guide the creation of your listening framework?
Yeah. Well, my mother was just so loving and kind and warm. And I mean, she lit up the room. But what I saw from a very young age is a woman who had such pain below the surface. She had lost her mother from childbirth. She always believed she was the cause of her mother's death. And that was an emptiness that was very difficult for her. And when she would express her pain because of her outward appearance, it was so hard for people to understand what was invisible. And they would kind of rush to remind her of just all the great things in her life and convince her that life was better now. And while that's important, it was also a way they weren't listening to her. And I saw that painful pattern versus when someone would really lean in and understand on a different level. And I saw the gift of understanding and what that did, as well as what the costs were. So because I learned that skill early, I was able to give that gift in a lot of ways, that gift of understanding through listening. And it became, as early as high school, something that helped me be successful. It's really the single thread to any of my successes. So I thought, well, if this is something that I can do, I'm pretty sure anybody can do it, because it takes pretty average things and makes them extraordinary.
You're talking about learning how to be empathetic?
So empathy is part of listening, but I believe that empathy is a result of listening, not the other way around. So the goal of listening is to understand, but just because we've heard something doesn't mean we understand it. So we need to learn to communicate what we understand, not just say that we understand. So if you're watching a movie that's emotional and gripping and draws you into the story, it's a lot easier to get interested in it, isn't it? The same is true when you're listening. It's easier to be empathetic when you're able to help somebody convey their emotions, convey their experience in a way that draws you in as the listener. So you learn to be empathetic through really good listening. You don't just have to show up and be empathetic. It's really hard to be empathetic to things you've never experienced.
You talk about that good listeners are in control of conversations, which seems kind of opposite to me, right? No, the speaker is in control of the conversation, not the listener. So being a listener actively instead of really passively, how can people take control of a conversation then without dominating it, as my wife accuses me of often?
Well, you're guiding conversations all day. Think about it. I'm here. You're my guide. I'm following you. You're not following me. That wouldn't go well. You know very well professionally. So how we guide matters, but it is a paradigm shift. It's that when we let the speaker be in charge and we think, oh, we just have to be quiet and let somebody speak, people will wander onto what I call conversational side trails. We are in the conversational woods all the time, and it's really easy to get lost and confused. So unless we're guiding the speaker to help us travel the path to understanding, we're going to get way off track pretty quickly, and I'm going to lose interest, frankly, and my brain is going somewhere else. So when I learn to be that guide, now I need the right tools and process to be the guide and to be effective, which is why I wrote about this, but that's what it requires. Otherwise, we're going to lose patience, we're going to lose interest, and it's really hard not to fall into some dangerous listening traps.
One of my biggest pet peeves in this digital age are people that say, hey, I can multitask with their phone in one hand and a conversation in the other hand. Drives me crazy. But the idea is here, it seems to me, that we need to focus on the present, right? And that's singular. And that's not all of these other things that are happening around us. So do you give people advice on how to feel not pressured all the time by something they can read on their phone in 10 minutes? It'll still be there rather than seeing it instantly.
Well, we have a lot of problems as it pertains to the digital stuff. One is that we're just atrophying further our ability to communicate effectively as humans because we've depersonalized it through these texting. So there's great uses for it, but it also is a deficiency because we don't get to build that muscle. But that, you know, that's the discipline of being in relationships. So phones are addictive. We know that they trap us like, you know, cigarettes did back in the day. They're wired to make us want more. And so we have to be disciplined in putting it down because we can't multitask. It's just not true. And most people without training listen at 25% efficiency anyway. So you add a task on top of that and you're just doomed. You're doomed.
Do businesses emphasize listening at all to their employees generally? I'm sure there's a lot of focus on presentation, on speaking, like we talked about earlier in the classroom situation, et cetera. But what about the listening side? Is that something now that businesses are thinking of more seriously, or is it also still an afterthought?
I think there's an assumption in businesses that it's important. And if I say it's important, then it will happen. So that's really where the gap is, that we think, again, we go back to the assumption that if I tell you to listen, then you'll listen. I mean, the number of times sales leaders have said to me, I tell my guys and ladies, if they have two ears and they have one mouth, use them in proportion. But then we go out and give them product training, process training, tell them how to speak to the client, and everything's around speaking. So the gap is not that people are starting to realize how important it is and really put more effort around that, but they don't necessarily see that they need to provide training. So it's like running's important. We're all going to run a marathon, but we're not going to train for it. That's what happens. It's like, oh, just go run it. We need to bridge. We rise to the level of training, not to the level of what we need in the moment.
Here's one thing I'm really worried about, Christine, that somebody now in a meeting, in a Zoom call, a Google Meets call, can click that little thing up in the upper right-hand corner and I can be yawning off and summarize what's been said. So instead of listening or paying attention, I know that I can just have AI summarize everything for me here in about 5 minutes anyway. And to me, that is just the opposite route that I think you're suggesting we should think about.
So I think this is where AI is a marvelous tool. And because a lot of people say to me, should I take notes? And notes are fine as long as you're not, it can be so encompassing that it can distract you. So if you let the AI do the work in terms of the note taking, but if you're only using it to summarize, you're likely missing really good aspects of the conversation that you need to create more understanding before those notes even matter. So the summary isn't enough. It's really the conversation. It's like AI can only give you the quality answers to the questions you ask it. It can't give you quality answers if you don't ask it the right questions. The same is true. So if you think that's the solve, it's only going to help you mimic. It's not going to help you understand.
Big difference right there, mimicking or understanding, in my view.
Yep.
As we wrap things up, tell me more about the listening path methodology that you write about.
Yeah, so the listening path is based on the metaphor. You wouldn't go hiking in the woods without tools or supplies in your backpack. And I mentioned earlier the conversational woods. So we give both children and adults the tools so they can listen to understand. And it is a step-by-step process that these tools are married together to ensure that that understanding not only happens for the listener, but that the speaker also knows that they are understood and there is a confirmation that there's understanding. Because what happens is most time we listen to it and that's where it stops. And we don't take those other steps. So if you're process oriented and you like a common language, the path is for you because it'll give you the language and tools to listen in a consistent way that's replicable and repeatable to get the result that you want over and over again.
I heard last week as we wrap it up, Christine, that music today, pop music, whatever, their length is generally 30 seconds shorter than it was a decade ago. The reason is because we don't have the attention span to dial it in for, you know, a little bit longer. It has to be short, condensed, and right now, otherwise we're going elsewhere.
Yeah.
Do you see that too?
Well, I think we are living in a very fast-paced world. So to keep somebody's attention, here's a nugget for your listeners. If you want to keep somebody's attention, tell them the most powerful story you can. And the most powerful story you can tell someone is their own. So when you listen to someone, tell them the story they just told you, and you will, 30 seconds, a minute and a half, 5 minutes, you will have their attention because people are thirsting to be heard, seen, and understood. And that is what captures people in this world of noise more than anything, is helping them feel seen, heard, and understood.
What's next for you, Christine?
Well, my mission is to bring listening education to schools around the world. So while we continue to serve businesses and help them sell, lead, influence, and so forth, I wanted to make listening education possible from elementary school and beyond. So we're going after the teachers to help bring listening education in. I have an animated classroom program that's plug and play and simple for teachers to implement so that we can build this critical life skill starting at age 6.
Christine Miles, her book is What Is It Costing You Not to Listen? The Power of Understanding to Connect, Influence, Solve, and Sell. It has been a pleasure, Christine. Thank you so much for joining us today on Main Street.
Thank you so much.
Coming up in the second half of today's show, it's another Plain Spoke essay by our good friend Dr. Tom Ezern from North Dakota State University. We'll also have a report on migrating birds that have challenges due to light pollution and window collisions. That comes from Harvest Public Media. Plus, we'll have our weekly check-in with our segment, Our Living Lands. That's all ahead, right here on Main Street, after this news. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. In the early 1900s, trachoma's contagious eye disease was a major public health concern and used to justify strict immigration inspections, especially targeting Eastern European immigrants. Today, Tom Ezern, in his Plainsfolk essay, recounts how the fear of trachoma intertwined with rising nativism in the United States, particularly impacting German-Russians seeking entry.
Trachoma, an infectious eye disease now handled readily with antibiotics, was considered a menace, the major cause of blindness early in the 20th century. It came to public attention in 1897 when Dr. Porter S. Wyman, Surgeon General of the U.S. Marines, issued a report calling trachoma a dangerous, contagious disease, after which inspectors at U.S. ports of entry commenced watch for it. Inspections of all immigrants, lifting of eyelids, looking for the telltale follicles underneath, were standard by 1905. Treatments were sketchy, commonly washes with various solutions, sometimes minor but painful surgery to scrape the inside of the eyelids. Although there was a lot of muddled thought attributing trachoma, sometimes called Egyptian ophthalmia, because Napoleon's armies were blamed for bringing it home from the Nile, or perhaps granular ophthalmia after the physical symptoms on the eyelids, whatever they called it, attributing the disease to lack of hygiene and poor living conditions. Medical people had a clear grasp it was a contagious disease, and public officials thought they could keep it out of the country. They were eager to do this because all this got wrapped up with the anti-immigrant nativism of the time. As the number of European immigrants reaching American shores got up to 1 million a year or more, and included many more people from unaccustomed Eastern European origins, such as Germans from Russia, headed for the Great Plains, including, as recounted earlier, Magdalena Klipfel, who made her way to Ashley, North Dakota by way of Canada, through means I am now ready to explain. For there were other German Russians trying to get into the United States and being rebuffed on account of trachoma. In 1901, Senator H.C. Hansbrough got involved with a case brought to him by constituents at Richardton. A relative of theirs, Benedict Freed, had made his way from Russia to Baltimore only to be detained on account of infection. He was said to have $2,000 in hand and be ready to buy a farm in North Dakota. He had come with 3 children in tow. I don't know the resolution of his case. What Mr. Freed needed to do was get in touch with a fellow named Louis Feigler in Neche, North Dakota. Feigler was what we today would call a coyote, a human smuggler operating on the border. There were many like him, according to the American agent stationed in Winnipeg to handle immigration matters. That official allowed, "There was no doubt a great deal of it went on," and said, "In every case, the persons captured were severely dealt with." If they were caught, that is. Feigler got tripped up in 1903. It seems 3 families of Germans from Russia, having been rejected in Winnipeg for entry into the States, took a train south to the border town of Gretna, where they were taken in hand by Feigler. He took them by back roads across the border to Bathgate, whence they proceeded on to Grand Forks. The German Russians, numbering 19 persons, were taken into custody there and deported. Feigler was arrested and charged in Fargo. I find no disposition of his case. So there was no way Magdalena Klipfel, with her medical record, could have entered North Dakota legally from Manitoba. Officials in Portal were rejecting anyone suspected of infection. 19 in one day, it was reported. Magdalena was a resourceful young woman, and she found someone like Louis Feigler, only smarter, to fetch her into North Dakota and the arms of her family in McIntosh County.
That was our dear friend, Dr. Tom Ezern, a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University, who shares with us each week his Plains Folk essays.
Whether you're a sustaining member or you give annually or you've made additional contributions to Prairie Public, we thank you. Your generous support invests directly in the programs and services you and your community enjoy and depend on. Thank you, Prairie Public members. We're humbled by your trust.
Making acid rain great again? That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
A company revealed last week that it has been secretly discussing a plan with the Trump administration to start mining the seabed in the Pacific Ocean.
A Canadian corporation, the Metals Company, is asking the U.S. government to bypass the International Seabed Authority's jurisdiction over mining global waters.
The U.S. has never ratified the treaty. However, in 1980, Congress enacted legislation to regulate seabed mining, and subsequent administrations have recognized the agency's authority.
The Metals Company intends to vacuum up nodules, potato-sized rocks that contain minerals used in electronics. A presidential executive order permitting the plans is being reviewed, according to the New York Times.
Seabed mining can potentially destroy habitats and generate noise pollution, detrimental to marine life that communicate through sound.
A new study from the UK, conducted in the same region where the metals company wants to operate between Mexico and Hawaii, concluded that animals in the deep ocean can take decades to recover from deep-sea mining activities.
The Canadian plans resulted in reactions from both environmentalists and governments, more than 30 of which are calling for a moratorium on seabed mining, saying, among other concerns, it could lead to an irreversible loss of biodiversity.
There's a drive in the U.S. to build small nuclear reactors that could meet the growing demand for electricity from artificial intelligence and other computing needs.
SMRs, or small modular reactors, have a generating capacity of about one-third that of traditional plants. If permits are approved by the federal government, a firm will begin operating two small reactors in Michigan in 2030.
Last year, 25 states passed laws supporting nuclear energy, and high-tech companies like Google, Meta, and Microsoft view SMRs as meeting their electricity needs from low-carbon fuels.
Supporters of nuclear power claim it's cleaner than fossil fuels because it produces no carbon emissions, and they assert that SMRs have simpler and more compact designs with reduced construction times and costs.
However, SMRs still produce nuclear waste, which breaks down over thousands of years. The Michigan facility plans to store their waste on site for up to 100 years. Additionally, there are unanswered questions about the safety of these new small reactors.
In 1990, the Clean Air Act was updated by Congress to eliminate acid rain by reducing power plant pollution. However, acid rain could make a comeback.
Says who? Says the guy who identified it in the 1960s. Back then, Gene Likens conducted experiments in a New Hampshire forest showing the impacts, which led to public outcry and eventually congressional action.
Last week, he told The Guardian that the Environmental Protection Agency under Trump is eliminating clean air and water regulations, which, coupled with the administration's desire to bring back coal, could drag the U.S. toward the toxic conditions of the 1970s.
Acid rain describes any form of precipitation, like snow, fog, hail, or rain, that contains high levels of sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxide. Most sources of these chemicals are from burning fossil fuels, specifically from coal-fired power plants, factories, and vehicles.
When acid rain falls into waterways, it can harm fish and other wildlife. It's also detrimental to plants and trees by robbing soils of nutrients. Acidic rain can even damage buildings and structures, causing them to corrode or deteriorate.
Working with Cornell University, Likens set up a monitoring system near New York's Finger Lakes. It's been running since 1976, but had its funding cut this month as part of the Trump administration's effort to shrink the size of government. And finally, most of us have a healthy respect for lightning and will seek shelter during thunderstorms. But the almendro tree, native to Central and South America, seems to dare nature to bring it on.
According to striking new research by the Cary Institute of Ecosystem Studies, the trees appear to thrive by getting zapped with millions of volts of electricity.
The shocking discovery was made by lead author Evan Gora, who, during field work in Panama, noticed that the almendro had survived a lightning strike with little damage, while more than a dozen neighboring trees died.
He saw that the strike had not only left the tree mostly unscathed, but it also killed parasitic vines, or lianas, clinging to its branches.
His ensuing research of over 90 trees in Panama concluded that almendro seek out lightning to weed out competition for light and nutrients, both from other trees and the infesting vines.
The team says almendro's wide branching habit and height make them natural lightning rods that are up to 70% more likely to get electrocuted than other trees, which in the end boosts the species' ability to produce offspring.
Climate change is increasing lightning in many regions, so that may give the almendro an edge. And given the trees can live up to 1,000 years, they will likely be hit more than once, uprooting the idiom that lightning never strikes twice.
That's it for this week in water. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Every spring and fall, millions of birds migrate through the Midwest, and many won't make it thanks to light pollution and window collisions. This story from Harvest Public Media explores how one Chicago building became a deadly trap for birds and what simple changes can help save them.
In 1978, David Willard was working at the Field Museum in Chicago when someone mentioned to him that birds kept slamming into the city's lakeside convention center, McCormick Place.
And it piqued my interest.
So he started checking for dead birds and realized McCormick was killing a lot of them.
It's not a building that I think anybody, when it was built, would predict would be a major bird killer.
It's not that tall. About three stories, he says, where the migrating birds tend to strike it in the spring and fall while flying along Lake Michigan.
But it is right on the lake and has a massive amount of glass.
Over the next 40 years, Willard and others from the Field Museum collected 40,000 birds there. They noted how many died when the building's lights were on versus off.
When lights were out, it was a dramatic reduction in the numbers that would be killed.
Most migrating birds fly in the dark, and it has been known for decades that artificial lights confuse them. But the research at McCormick quantifies the problem. When the building's windows were all lit up, bird deaths rose tenfold compared to when just half the windows were lit up. Countrywide, the latest estimates suggest that 1 billion birds die annually by colliding with human-made structures.
And so that's like a bird every 30 seconds.
Andrew Farnsworth is a visiting scientist at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. Cornell research shows that as spring gets underway, 7 of the country's top 10 riskiest cities for migrating birds are in the middle of the country, like Dallas, Kansas City, and Chicago. Farnsworth says these cities lie along one of the most important migration corridors on the planet.
There is an incredible, you know, tailwind scenario because of the way the Gulf of Mexico is positioned.
So light pollution on this route is especially problematic. Many confused birds slam into lit buildings. Others land in bright cities and wait for daytime. Many of these then hit windows because they see reflections of the sky or greenery. But buildings can be made safer for birds. Take McCormick Place in Chicago. Here's Willard again.
In the past, we would watch them fly straight into the window and drop.
But now,
we'd watch them fly in and veer.
Last summer, McCormick installed clear film with white dots every few inches at a cost of $1.2 million to cover 2 football fields worth of windows. When the next fall migration came, researchers found just 18 birds hit the treated glass, a 95% decrease. Willard is eager to see if this trend holds up in the spring. There are other ways to help, too. Shutting off nighttime facade lighting and unneeded office lights during peak migration season. These lights out programs are growing in the middle of the country. And Farnsworth at Cornell says you do not need to own a big building to help.
The notion that the problem is just in cities is wrong. Your kitchen window, your living room window, your glass door, whatever it is when you walk outside and you find a dead bird beneath glass, you can address that.
For example, by turning off extra lights at home or drawing your curtains at night or treating your windows. How to get started?
Frankly, the easiest thing, visiting American Bird Conservancy's website.
abcbirds.org. It explains lots of options. Good old window screens, subtle vertical cords, translucent tape stripes. These all help birds see glass and know it's a solid thing they should not approach. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Celia Yopis Jepson.
Harvest Public Media is a collaboration of public media newsrooms throughout the Midwest and Great Plains, which reports on food systems, environment, and rural life. Thank you.
is Bird Note. The month of April inspires poets, sometimes with contradictory results. T.S. Eliot describes April as the cruelest month, breeding lilacs out of the dead land. Shakespeare strikes an upbeat note, noting April hath put a spirit of youth in everything. Let's allow April, through the voice of nature, to speak for itself. Step outside and listen to the birds. In southeastern Alaska, the exuberant voice of a ruby-crowned kinglet rings from a streamside willow. In a Washington state marsh, a common yellowthroat perches atop a cattail as it belts out its galloping tune. In South Texas, the intricate musical phrasing of a long-billed thrasher rambles forth from a thicket. In a dense Midwestern shrub, a brown thrasher holds forth. The slender, secretive thrasher prefers singing from the shadows. From a nearby evergreen come the pure whistled notes of a white-throated sparrow. This sweet music will ring through many northern forests all across the continent. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Buffalo are a key species for the environment and indigenous communities. Our Living Lands producer, Daniel Spalding, spoke with Don Sherman, the executive director of the Tonka Fund and a member of the Lakota, Shawnee, and Delaware tribes about the importance of returning buffalo to indigenous land.
The return of buffalo to ancestral lands is a powerful moment for many indigenous nations. Can you talk about the work that Tonka Fund does, and what does buffalo mean to the Tonka Fund and how their return impacts cultural revitalization efforts?
Our mission at Tonka Fund is to return buffalo to the lands, lives, and economies of indigenous peoples. So Tonka Fund was born out of Kyle, South Dakota, which is on the Pine Ridge Reservation. And because the buffalo was part of who we are, it's our ancestor, it's our relative, we saw the need for our ranchers that they just didn't have access. You know, we're in a huge 2.9 million square acres, and there's cattle all around us. Like, we're in a protein factory, but there's no buffalo. You know, none of our relatives are, you know, there are very few of our relatives on that land. So we saw that, and they didn't have access to get that buffalo into the market too, right? If they wanted to feed their people, it leaves the reservation and it may never come back, that meat, right? So we saw that our ranchers did need support, and that buffalo deserved to be on this land because they are the keystone species. And by returning the buffalo, you revitalize the culture, right? So bringing that back brings all of that connection back that we had with the buffalo, and that's our role there. We're stewards to the buffalo who are the voiceless and giving them the voice, and we're stewards to those ranchers to try to assist them bringing those buffalo back to the lands and to the different cultures, because we represent probably 10 tribes right now in Tonka Fund, and we'll be adding more all the time throughout the year.
What are some of the biggest challenges faced in, you know, making these buffalo restoration efforts a reality? And also, what are some of the biggest successes that you've seen this far?
So it's the access to land, the access to the capital, and then the opportunities that we're not given to us that were given to the rest of the country while we were sitting without those opportunities. And then the great things, I would say, watching those buffalo run on the land for the first time in 200 years. One of our ranchers, she's up in Cheyenne River, got buffalo this year, and she got some yearlings, and it was the first time they've touched her family's land in 200 years that buffalo's ever touched that grass. So to see that, it still gives me goosebumps. We've been in this for 12 years, and I have been, and just to watch those buffalo and to see the smile on our people's faces and to know that that's where they belong, that's where our relatives belong, is on this land.
That's awesome. And that kind of leads into my next question that I had is, you know, buffalo play a crucial role in maintaining healthy ecosystems. And how does their introduction contribute to land restoration and biodiversity in, you know, the regions that they're being released in?
They were built for this land. And we've all heard their hooves aerate the land. It helps penetrate the soil to help aerate it. But also it gets them down into that seed bank, which most people don't understand within, you know, the grass prairies and stuff. And, you know, 6 to 8 feet down, there's a seed bank of historical seed. And as they're walking, right, it's distributing and it feeds the birds. You know, they have a symbiotic nature to many animals, such as the black-footed ferret and the magpie. And so without the buffalo, those animals pretty much almost went extinct. When the buffalo went away, the ferrets were, you know, and they're just now getting reintroduced again over these last many years. So it's really that symbiotic nature. They graze based on the seasons and their diets, so they don't overgraze and down to the root. The wallowing creates water holes for amphibians and bugs and other animals to come and eat. So as they're moving through the grasslands, you can actually see the changes that happen over many years of, you know, the return of natural prairies, natural grasses, and different types of animals.
And lastly, what does the future look like for buffalo restoration, and how has, you know, climate change impacted these efforts that the Tonga Fund does?
Buffalo are pretty resilient, just like our people. We're very resilient, so they are adjusting to these extreme changes as far as the cold, the floods, and, you know, the heat and things such as that. The main thing is just giving them enough space and healthy food and water. So I would say the future looks really bright. The collaborations between groups, DC, government, NGOs, nonprofits such as ourselves are all really collaborating to make sure that we keep these animals on the land, because we see how needed they are, because they're our relatives, right, and our ancestors, and they deserve the same opportunity we had.
Tune in next week for more stories about how climate change affects tribal communities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 1st. April Fool's Day has been around for centuries, with pranks and practical jokes ending in the cry of, "April Fool!" Many historians trace its origins to 1582, when France switched from the Julian calendar to the Gregorian calendar. The Julian calendar began the new year on the spring equinox around April 1st, while the Gregorian calendar starts the year on January 1st. People who refused to adopt the new calendar continued celebrating the new year on the equinox. Others were slow to get the news and didn't realize the rest of the country had already celebrated months earlier. These people became the butt of jokes called Poisson d'Avril, or April Fish, symbolizing a gullible, easily caught person. In the 18th century, the holiday spread to Britain and continued to grow in popularity. By the early 20th century, it became a favorite celebration in America, with jokes and parties happening on or around April 1st. In 1918, young people held an April Fool's party at the First Baptist Church in Grand Forks, featuring stunts, silly games, and practical jokes. In 1925, the Trinity Lutheran Church in Bismarck hosted an April Fool's party, where partygoers were encouraged to wear your clothes backside first. Come and join us if you durst. We'll make you laugh until you burst. A few days earlier, the Ladies Auxiliary of the Odd Fellows held a party with a scavenger hunt for a peanut, one that was never found because no peanut had been hidden. Though April Fool's parties were mostly for young people, adults also enjoyed the fun. In 1937, the Newcomers Club of Bismarck threw a party for members with jokes and stunts. Adult card parties and church groups also regularly hosted events centered around April Fool's Day. While the lavish parties of the past are less common today, the holiday is still recognized. Many companies launch fake products like hot dog-flavored bottled water. So as you head out today, stay alert for jokes and pranks that may be waiting for you. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Ann Alquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for this Tuesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. Thank you so much for joining us. Remember, you can hear this and all past episodes of Main Street at our website at prairiepublic.org or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month, And tomorrow on Main Street, we'll have experts from the North Dakota Domestic and Sexual Violence Coalition, and they'll focus on image-based sexual violence, which includes non-consensual intimate image sharing, sextortion, and deep fakes. And it impacts many here in North Dakota. We'll explore that tomorrow, right here on Main Street.